this class, entitled The History of Musical Instruments in Worship, was taught at Winchester Reformed Presbyterian Church in Winchester, Kansas. For more information, visit us at winchesterrp.com. Well, good morning. This morning, we're going to be shifting gears. For the last several weeks, we've been looking at the issue of exclusive psalmody. And this week and next week, if the Lord is willing, we are going to transition to talk about a second distinctive of our worship, our being the Reformed Presbyterian Church in North America. The second distinctive, which is the way in which we sing, which happens to be without musical instruments. That shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone here or anyone who has stepped foot across the threshold to worship in a Reformed Presbyterian church. We do not use musical instruments in our singing to the Lord. And that's not because pianos are too much of a burden upon our budget. I've been asked that before, and that's certainly not the reason. The reason is a biblical conviction. We do not believe that musical instruments should be used in the worship of God. Now, that doesn't mean we don't let our students and our young people play musical instruments. We have no problem with that, just like we have no problem with listening to all kinds of music, even though we only sing the Psalms in worship. So this is not because we're anti-music or anti-musical instruments. It simply has to do with the context of our worship. And we don't believe that musical instruments have a place in the worship of God under the new covenant. And just as we did with the exclusive psalmody, I want to do again this morning and next week, if the Lord is willing, and that is to really ease us into this topic. I don't know how often in the past this has been reviewed or explained why it is that we don't use musical instruments. I'm going to assume, for the sake of teaching this morning, that in some ways we're beginning with a blank slate. And so we're going to ease into it. And this morning, what I really want to do is give, again, more of a pragmatic reason why we don't use musical instruments. Next week, we will be looking at the biblical reason we do not use musical instruments. I think there is a biblical argument to be made. And I think it's very persuasive. But this morning, we're going to focus primarily on a pragmatic reason. And that pragmatic reason finds itself situated in the history of the church. I understand that in today's world, the Reformed Presbyterian Church, and not using musical instruments, that in today's world, at least in our own culture and society, it is a very strange thing to not use musical instruments. They are, after all, in some ways, all the modern craze. You have praise bands and you have full ensembles, and people really get into that. They really enjoy it. And so when they first come and experience something where you're singing unaccompanied with musical instruments, it can seem very strange, and it seems strange to me when I first experienced it as well. But maybe just a brief autobiographical note. I became convinced of no musical instruments far easier and quite a bit before I became convinced of exclusive psalmody. And so despite the fact that it's weird, the reason we're looking at church history today, and we're just going to do a flyby, literally, we're going to try to cover some 2,000 years of church history, which is not an easy task to accomplish in a Sunday school class. But the reason I want to do that is, if I can do anything this morning, I want to inject you with a little bit of confidence. And the confidence is this: that the way in which we worship God, that is, without the use of musical instruments, strange as it may be today, is really the overwhelming consensus of the church throughout history. As we're going to see, it took centuries for musical instruments to be introduced into the worship of the church. When the Reformation occurred, it again took centuries for musical instruments to be incorporated into the worship of churches that followed the Calvinistic Reformation. And even then, as we'll see this morning, the use of musical instruments was largely restricted to either the organ. It wasn't until the 20th century that the piano was introduced. And it is actually a very novel invention, a very modern-day invention, to have an entire praise band. And so my aim this morning is simply to inject you, as I've said, with a little bit of confidence that we are not that strange when held up to the light of church history. And you'll see on the board this morning that I have included a timeline. It's going to give us the five periods that we're primarily going to look at. We're going to begin with the period of the Jewish synagogue, which, well, we'll look at the dates of that in a moment. We're going to look at the early church fathers. We're going to look at the Dark Ages. We are going to look at the Reformation, and we are going to look at modernity, modern church history. And what I want you to see, and I think will be shown, is that by and large, throughout the history of the church, musical instruments have not been used in the worship of God. And so the first place that I want to begin this morning is simply with the Jewish synagogue. We're not going to get into a ton of details with this because that is largely left to the scholars. But I wonder this morning if anybody remembers or knows what a synagogue was and why it kind of began to appear in the religious practices of the Jewish people. Well, scholars debate exactly when the synagogue began to appear. Some people date it back all the way to when Moses led the people to the border of the Promised Land. He died and Joshua led them in. And some scholars say it was at their entrance into the Promised Land that the synagogues began to pop up. Other people will say, well, the synagogue was largely established after the temple, the first temple, was destroyed and the people of Israel went into exile. When exactly the synagogue began is not my primary concern. But the synagogue, very easily defined, was simply a place of worship. You'll remember that in the Old Testament, prior to the coming of Jesus Christ, the very center of Israel's religion was centered around the temple. The temple was the primary place where the worship of God occurred. Of course, that's where the ceremonies and the rituals and the priests and the Ark of the Covenant and the Shekinah glory of God all dwelt there in the temple. And it is believed, from my understanding and from my reading, and as you know, the temple was located in Jerusalem. There was only one temple. And there were parts of the year, times of the year, where every Jewish male was expected to go to Jerusalem to worship at the temple. But from my understanding and my reading is that these synagogues began to pop up as places of worship, places where Jews could still go to worship God who were not able to go and worship God on his holy mountain in the temple. And so these synagogues began to pop up around Israel, and that's where people began to worship God when they could not worship God in the temple. And it's very interesting from the scholarship that I have read, and very important to note this morning, that in the synagogue, in synagogue worship, what the Jews actually did. The Jews prayed. They read the scriptures. They had the scriptures explained. They sang psalms. But in many ways, that's about as far as synagogue worship went. What is noticeably absent from synagogue worship are those rites and those ceremonies and those sacrifices that required the temple. And so synagogue worship was not temple worship. And whatever was distinctly tied to the temple, the Jews would not bring into their synagogue worship. But prayer was not specifically tied to the temple. And so, well, we can pray in the synagogue. The reading and the explanation of scriptures, the singing of psalms was not particular to the temple. And so that could be brought into synagogue worship. And if synagogue worship looks and sounds a little bit like our worship, there's a reason for that. Many scholars are agreed that synagogue worship really set the pattern for the worship of the church under the new covenant. It was not temple worship that set the pattern. It was the synagogue. And the reason I bring this up this morning is because, very interestingly, one of the things that is noticeably absent from synagogue worship are musical instruments. Even though the people sang the psalms, they did not incorporate the musical instruments that God commanded in 1 Chronicles to David and after him to the kings who would lead in worship. They did not include those musical instruments that were commanded by God for temple worship. And that's because the Jews understood that the musical instruments that God had commanded, just like the sacrifices, just like the rituals, just like the ceremonies, were tied very specifically to the temple. And so they wouldn't worship God with the use of musical instruments because they weren't worshiping in the temple. I think there's some imagery to that in that psalm, and I can't remember the exact reference, but where we read that as the Jews were led into exile, they hung their harps in the trees, unable to play their music anymore because the temple had been destroyed. The Jews understood the musical instruments have a relationship to the temple, but when we're not worshiping in the temple, we're not to use musical instruments, just like we don't offer sacrifices. And even after the destruction of the temple in 70 AD, where Israel lost all of their temple rites and all of their temple ceremonies, the Jews, from my understanding, largely to this day, still do not use musical instruments in their worship because musical instruments are tied to the temple. That's how they understood it. And from my understanding, and I can be fact-checked on this, but from my understanding, it wasn't until 1958 that Orthodox Jews, so just in the last 60 years, that Orthodox Jews began to use some instruments in their worship. And even that is highly debated, whether they should be doing that or not. But the Jews understood, hey, musical instruments belong to the temple. They don't belong to synagogue worship. Now, we don't believe that we should be worshiping God in the temple any longer. We don't believe that there will ever come a time where the temple is reestablished and the sacrifices and those things are reestablished. But I bring this up, and this will become important as we move to a biblical argument, because while the Jews certainly have many things wrong, I think they have this right. And I think it's interesting for us to note that they understood that to be tied to temple worship. Well, as we move on from the Jewish synagogue, really the second period of church history I want to think about this morning is what we might call the early church fathers. So the early church, and that would span from about 100 AD to 600 AD. So the Jewish temple, the second temple, was destroyed in 70 AD, and now we're going to jump forward just about 30 years to 100 AD and carry it forth here till the year 600. And without trying to play the part of a historian, and these are the things historians argue about, that is a pretty decent time frame for us to think about the early church. And what I want to point out, and I'm going to be throwing some names and some dates up there. I don't know if you all will be familiar with some of the names, but if you're somewhat familiar with church history, some of them should resonate with you. Is that in this period between 100 and 600 AD, we find that history is not simply silent on the issue of musical instruments, but that the early church fathers, as John Price pointed out in his book on this issue, the early church fathers unanimously and vehemently argued against the use of musical instruments in worship. In many ways, it was for the first 600 years of the New Testament church taken for granted that musical instruments are not to be used in worship. Now, I wanted to preface that just by saying that the early church fathers had various reasons for saying that. Some early church fathers, like the Jews before them, believed that musical instruments were part of the ceremonial worship of the Jews, not to be carried over into the New Testament church. Some early church fathers, with a wrong interpretation of Scripture, they had a whole together pretty wrong method at times, believed that musical instruments should be interpreted figuratively. And we'll get into that a little more when we deal with the biblical argument. And the third reason some of the early church fathers argued against the use of musical instruments is simply their association with pagans and with pagan cults, that they did not believe we should be borrowing from the culture around us to bring things into the worship of God. So they had various reasons. I'm not saying all of them would agree with us or that we would agree with them, but what I do want to point out is that unanimously and vehemently, they argued against the use of musical instruments. So who would some of these early church fathers be? Well, to just give you a bit of a laundry list of names, if you've ever heard the name Ignatius of Antioch. Ignatius of Antioch was born probably in 35 AD, so we're dating him right back really to the end of Jesus' earthly ministry shortly thereafter. I believe it was Ignatius who is believed to have been a disciple of the Apostle John. So here is a man who was well acquainted with the apostles, who himself probably labored with the Apostle John, who died in 107 AD, which is just years after the New Testament canon was closed and there were no more books of the Bible being written. And Ignatius argues that musical instruments should not be used in worship. Another person in church history you may be familiar with, I know our students downstairs are because we've been talking about him in our juniors class, but is Justin Martyr, one of the earliest and most famous of all Christian apologists. Justin Martyr lived between the years 100 and 165 AD. And Justin Martyr actually writes against the use of musical instruments in worship, and he says, "We no more use musical instruments than we circumcise our children as a Jewish rite." Justin Martyr understood or believed that musical instruments were a Jewish ceremony. They were a Jewish rite, and the New Testament church wasn't to practice musical instruments anymore, just as we don't practice circumcision for religious reasons. And so that was Justin Martyr. After Justin Martyr, let me throw up another name here, Clement of Alexandria. Clement of Alexandria lived between 150 and 215 AD, so another very early church father. And Clement of Alexandria argued against the use of musical instruments, in part because they were associated with pagan cults, they were associated with the culture around them, but also because he believed that musical instruments had been replaced, so to speak, from my understanding, with the human body. That the human body, the heart, the lips, the tongue, that is our instrument of praise. Following Clement of Alexandria is Origen. If you've ever heard his name, you should be familiar with him if you know anything about early church history. A very famous early church father living from the years 185 to 254. Origen argued as well against the use of musical instruments in worship. And he did so because he understood musical instruments to be spiritually, he interpreted them in a spiritual manner. And so to think that we are to bring real literal instruments into worship, he did not believe should be done. Another name you might be somewhat familiar with is the name Eusebius. Eusebius is really the leading historian of the early church. So much of what we know about the early church and many of the things going on during that time comes from Eusebius. Eusebius lived from 260 until 339 AD. And Eusebius argues in his histories that not only are there theological reasons, he believed that musical instruments were no longer appropriate with the maturity of the new covenant, that we were not to go back again to these Jewish ceremonies. That would be to bring the church back to its state of infancy. But Eusebius in his histories also kind of, from my understanding, begins to paint a picture that this is a pretty common position. That Eusebius isn't alone in holding it, and it's really a universal opinion that the church at this time was all agreed. We're not to use musical instruments in worship. A name that I know all of you are familiar with, one of the greatest of the church fathers, Augustine. Augustine lived from 354 to 430. His impact and his influence can hardly be overrated. He is probably, since the days of the apostles, the greatest theologian to ever have lived and interacted with the Church of Jesus Christ. Augustine is a powerhouse in many things. And Augustine also argued that musical instruments should not be used in worship. He believed this. He believed the same thing that those before him and those Jews that worshipped in the synagogue, that musical instruments have no place in the new covenant worship of God. Gregory the Great, or excuse me, before we get to Gregory the Great, maybe we want to say something about Constantine. Constantine, of course, was not so much a church father as he was the emperor who ushered in the Holy Roman Empire. And what's very interesting to note is that in Constantine's day, when Christianity finally became not only legal, but really the religion of the empire, all kinds of resources, all kinds of money, all kinds of manpower went into really beautifying, building cathedrals, and really the aesthetic appeal of the worship of God. But what did not happen under Constantine's reign, even though the churches were being built up and elegant cathedrals built and whatever else, there's no record that even Constantine, with all his delight in aesthetics, brought musical instruments into worship. That was something that even he wouldn't do. And Gregory the Great, if you're familiar with him, 540 to 604 AD, Gregory the Great argued that musical instruments should not be brought into the church. And that's significant coming from Gregory because if you know anything about him, he did a lot to develop the music of the church. Gregorian chants, Gregory the Great. But even he, with all of his beliefs on music and development of music, even he did not believe musical instruments should be incorporated into worship. So those are individuals, but also worthy of note here during this time, in case you care, are that two councils of the early church ruled that musical instruments have no place in worship. So, for instance, the Council of Laodicea, which occurred in 367 AD, the Council of Laodicea ruled that musical instruments ought not to be brought into the worship of God. And if you're familiar with Eastern Christianity, right, in some ways we're Western Christians, we speak very different languages, not just, I'm speaking theological languages, than Eastern Orthodoxy. But to this day, the Eastern Church does not use musical instruments in worship because of the Council of Laodicea. That goes back to 367. They still find that to be a binding council. So if you were to go to an Eastern Orthodox church, they would not be using musical instruments, the whole of the Eastern tradition. And that's a significant part, broadly defined, of Christendom. And they do not, to this day, use those. The other council was the Council of Carthage. And the Council of Carthage met in 416. And they ruled that musical instruments had no place in the church, that we should silence and have no musical instruments incorporated into worship. So what we see is some continuity here. There is some discontinuity, but some continuity that in the early church, just like the synagogue worship, the greatest minds of Christianity, some of the councils of Christianity that took up this matter, unanimously and vehemently insisted that musical instruments not be used in worship. Which brings us to our third period this morning in church history, which is the Dark Ages. And if you're familiar with the Dark Ages, just very briefly, the Dark Ages were a time of great decline of the Holy Roman Empire. The Holy Roman Empire began to be fractured and to fall apart, and all of culture went into really a steep decline and descent, and there was a great deterioration in the world, which is why it's called the Dark Ages. Now, it was during this time, so if we date the Dark Ages from roughly 600 to 1300, again, I'm not a historian, I'm not going to argue hard and fast for dates, but it is actually in the period of the Dark Ages that we begin to see musical instruments pop up in worship. And scholars are agreed, from my research, from my reading and understanding, that the first musical instrument came into a church in 670 AD. 600 years after the Second Temple was destroyed, a musical instrument finds its way into the church. And this was under Pope Vitellianus, if I'm saying that correctly. And it was an organ. For the first time, an organ was brought into a church. I don't know about you, I have always thought that the organ is the definitive argument against the use of musical instruments in church. All right, I'm just kidding, I just don't care for the organ. Maybe some of you do. But it was in 670 AD that the first musical instrument entered church. The second musical instrument, as scholars are agreed, entered into a church in 812 AD. So what, 140-some years after the first musical instrument is brought into a church, a second musical instrument is brought into a church. And this time, from my understanding, it was an organ. It was a gift from Charlemagne to the Catholic Church. And so still, within the first 800 years of the New Testament church history, now you have two organs, and that's all that you have. Well, as the Dark Ages began to decline, and maybe it's worth noting that the Dark Ages were a dark period for the church as well. Of course, it was many of the superstitions, many of the things that came out of the Dark Ages that spurred on the Protestant Reformation. But recognized by Protestant and Catholic scholars alike, the Dark Ages were not exactly the golden ages of the church. So the Dark Ages were a time of deterioration in the church, as a whole, recognized by Protestants and Roman Catholics. And so in 812 AD, you have the second musical instrument brought into the church. And from there, it is fair to say, as we look at history, that musical instruments began to increase in more popularity. But it probably wasn't until the late 900s that they became more common in churches. And just to qualify this again, when I say musical instruments, I really mean one, and that is the organ. And while they became more and more popular, even in the 10th century, it wasn't until the late 1200s, so we're looking at the late 13th century, that musical instruments really had a general acceptance. They kind of became somewhat commonplace, and it was in the 14th and 15th centuries that the organ became nearly universal in all the churches. But let me just pause here. Even in the 1200s, we have the most famous of all theologians of the Dark Ages, and really one of the most famous of all theologians in the history of the church, probably named up there with Augustine, Thomas Aquinas, who wrote in the 13th century. And Thomas Aquinas as well, like Augustine, argued musical instruments should not be used in worship. They are to revert back to the temple worship of the Jews. So even though they were gaining general acceptance, even though they were increasingly becoming universal, you still have the leading theologians of the church arguing that there is no reason why musical instruments should be in the worship of God. In fact, they would regard it as having been forbidden. And interestingly enough, even up until the 16th century, which catapults us a little further than the Dark Ages, up until the 16th century, even though organs were in the cathedrals, from my understanding, they were not played when the Pope was present. I'm not going to explain why or try to interpret that. I don't know why for sure. But even when the Pope was present in the worship of God, they were not used. But again, it's very important to note that in the Dark Ages, in the decline of the church, worship became very much a sensory experience. If you want to think about it in these terms, one of the damaging things about this period in church history is that they really reverted back or desired to have what you might call more of a temple type of worship. They wanted something that appealed to all the senses rather than the plain, simple spiritual worship of the synagogue. And so it was during this time that in many ways, they turned back to some of the ideas, some of the imagery, some of the things pertaining to the temple. And perhaps it's even interesting enough to think of the rise of the Mass in this time, and the perpetual sacrifice that is being offered every time the priest partook of Mass. So it was during the Dark Ages that musical instruments began to be incorporated into the worship of the Christian church. The Western church, we should say. That was not true from my understanding of the Eastern church. But even some of the greatest theologians of the Western church, like Thomas Aquinas, still argued that they had no place in the worship of God. Well, that brings us to our fourth period of church history, which is the Reformation. And I know most people date the Reformation beginning in 1517 when Martin Luther nailed the 95 Theses to the door in Wittenberg. But there were some precursors to the Reformation. If you're familiar with the name John Wycliffe, of course, if you know much about the translations of Scripture, you know that the Wycliffe Bible, and still today the Wycliffe organization that is committed to translating the Scriptures, named after this man. John Wycliffe lived from 1320 until 1384. And one of the things that John Wycliffe was very concerned about was reclaiming the church from this sensual form of worship. that we ought not to be worshiping God in a way that appeals to sensuality, to the way that appeals to our senses. But we need to get back to the plain, ordinary, simple worship of the New Testament church. It was at that time, around that time as well, that John Huss, another precursor to the Reformation, 1369 to 1415, he came onto the scene and was also somewhat concerned with the worship of the church. And both of these men taught that part of getting back to the simplicity was getting rid of the musical instrument that had been incorporated into the worship of the church. And that brings us, broadly speaking, to Martin Luther himself in 1517. Now, we're not going to get much into Martin Luther this morning. All that I want to say is that Luther, to paint with a very broad brush, again, I'm not a historian, but Luther really saw that the Reformation centered more on doctrine than it did on worship. In Martin Luther's mind, worship was a secondary issue. It wasn't that important. In fact, it came from Luther and the Lutheran tradition where we got the normative principle of worship, not the regulative principle, but the normative principle of worship that says we may worship God in whatever way is not forbidden in the Scriptures. And so Luther didn't concern himself entirely with the worship of the church. He wasn't interested in reforming that as he was in reforming the teaching and the doctrine and a view of Christian life in the church. But we're not going to spend much time on Luther. He doesn't share our principles of worship. We would disagree with him strongly on some of those things. But it is important to note that Luther was fine with musical instruments, and that throughout the rest of history, dating from the Reformation to the modern day, churches following after him, like the Lutheran Church, to an extent some of the Anglicans, did use musical instruments and began to incorporate them into the worship of the church. But, of course, our reformer of choice, if we have to have one, is probably John Calvin. And John Calvin believed that the Reformation was not only a reformation of doctrine, but it was to be a reformation of worship. And John Calvin was very, very concerned with reforming the worship of the church. And it was largely from his writings that for the first time, it was very systematized. We believe the apostles believed it, but for the first time, it was very systematized what we mean by the regulative principle of worship. If it's not commanded, we don't do it. And John Calvin came, and you can read him in his commentaries, especially his commentary on the Psalms, and John Calvin came out against the use of musical instruments. He believed to use musical instruments in worship was to return to Jewish forms of worship. It was to return the church to a state of infancy, whereas in Jesus Christ, we have actually grown up, and so we've put those childish things behind us. And so Calvin was very concerned with reforming the worship of the church and spoke very strongly against the use of musical instruments. And following in his footsteps would have been almost unanimously all of the reformers. Again, just like the early church fathers, a unanimity here and a vehemency here that musical instruments have no place in the worship of the church. That's not because they hated music. They weren't prudes. Many of them loved music. They just believed when it came to the worship of the church, musical instruments are not to be used. So some of those following in Calvin's footsteps, that whose names you were probably familiar with, John Knox, really looked at as one of the fathers of Presbyterianism. John Knox was very strongly opposed to musical instruments. The Puritans, we're not going to talk much about what makes a Puritan and what dates they were, but the Puritans who were responsible for writing our Confession of Faith, the Westminster Confession of Faith, the larger and shorter catechisms. The Puritans, with united voice, a man named Richard Baxter being the singular exception from my understanding, the Puritans, with united voice, rejected the use of musical instruments in the worship of God. Matthew Henry, if you are familiar with his name, perhaps you have or have read his commentaries, a very famous set of commentaries, Matthew Henry argued that musical instruments have no place in the worship of God. John Bunyan, the author of Pilgrim's Progress, like the best-selling Christian book, I think the best-selling book next to the Bible in the history of books, John Bunyan did not believe musical instruments had a place in the worship of God. Add to that the name of a man named John Gill, who's a little later than these guys, but John Gill, who again, his commentaries are often consulted, often read, a Calvinistic Baptist, John Gill believed musical instruments had no place in the worship of God. And if you were to begin to add more names to this throughout this period until roughly the late 18th century, you would find some very interesting names on this list. Isaac Watts, who is the author of many hymns that are sung in hymn-singing churches. Isaac Watts did not believe musical instruments had a place in the worship of God. John and Charles Wesley, again, the whole branch of Methodism branching off from them, also some of the most famous hymn writers. John and Charles Wesley did not believe in musical instruments in worship. I forget which Wesley brother it was, but he said, you know, an organ is fine so long as it's completely silent in the church. So kind of a little bit of a humorous way to say that. My own historical hero, my favorite preacher in the history of the church, Charles Spurgeon, who lived into or the late 19th century, Charles Spurgeon did not, again, a Calvinistic Baptist, did not believe musical instruments had a place in worship. These are not people who agree with us on exclusive psalmody. Spurgeon had the only hymn book named after, I think, one of his elders or deacons, and it was their hymn book. He sang all kinds of hymns. But Charles Spurgeon once said that, I don't care if there's an organ in the church so long as it's filled with lead. Charles Spurgeon, very much opposed to the use of musical instruments. Andrew Fuller, for whom Fuller Seminary is named after, a very influential, a very famous Baptist, Andrew Fuller argued that musical instruments as well have no place in worship. And so what I want you to see from this brief list is that coming out of the Reformation, Baptists, Reformed folk, Presbyterians across the spectrum did not believe that musical instruments should be used in the worship of God. And this is our roots. This is many of our roots. Whether you're Baptist, whether you're Reformed, whether you're Presbyterian, those who have gone before us coming out of the Reformation with united consent believed that musical instruments had no place in New Covenant worship. So that might lead you to ask, well then, if that many people argued about it and the church seemed to agree, what happened? Well, that brings us to our final period of church history, which is really modern church history. And I'm dating that to really the late 18th century. And in 1763, there was a little pamphlet that was published, and I forget the exact name of it, but it was published in New England, and it was a pamphlet that argued for the use of musical instruments. That was the first time, from my understanding, in colonial America where such an invention was being argued for. And they used one biblical argument in that pamphlet, the author did, and that was, well, the Psalms tell us to use musical instruments, so that's good enough for me, we should use musical instruments. Of course, and we'll be looking at this when we look at the biblical argument, the Psalms also tell us to offer sacrifices and to tie the sacrifice to the altar and to keep the festivals. But we don't say, well, just because the Psalms say it, we should do that. Otherwise, this pamphlet argued that musical instruments have a very nice aesthetic value, and so they should be incorporated into worship. Well, from my understanding, this caused quite a bit of buzz. This caused quite a bit of debate and controversy. It was kind of a novel idea, and it wasn't overly well received by the majority. Despite that being published in 1763, in 1770, the first musical instrument really showed up in New England, in a church in New England. And I don't remember off the top of my head which church that was. I think it was a congregational church. But in 1770 was the first time in the New World that a musical instrument was brought in, and it caused a lot of debate. But from there, it began to gain some traction in the churches. Our Baptist brothers and our Baptist sisters, aside from the Presbyterians, were the ones who, it seems, held out the longest. And they did not incorporate a musical instrument into the Baptist churches of America until the 1820s. There was a Baptist church in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, that first used, that first brought in those musical instruments. And from my understanding, those Presbyterians, bringing themselves back to the Presbyterianism of Scotland, it wasn't until the late 19th century that musical instruments began to be used in their churches. How did that happen? How did this rapid increase happen? Well, there's probably a lot of factors, but one of them, agreed upon by many people, is that if you're familiar with the name D.L. Moody, D.L. Moody was an evangelist of the 19th century. Moody Bible Institute is named after him. D.L. Moody was an evangelist, and he would hold set revival meetings throughout our land, and I believe he went to Europe as well. And D.L. Moody had a man, and I forget his name, that traveled around with him who had a collapsible organ. So he could pack up and bring his organ with him. And D.L. Moody felt that this man and his organ music was something that might really attract the young people, that could be used for evangelistic purposes. And so he began to incorporate the organ into his revival meetings. And the Presbyterians opened their door to D.L. Moody to come in and use their churches and to help encourage these revivals. And from there, it seems that the organ began to spread like wildfire. And I bring that up because I think it's important to see that by and large, within our circles, so to speak, that's Protestant, Calvinistic, the use of musical instruments were not, from my understanding, really first brought into the worship for biblical reasons. It wasn't that at that time the church said, oh, well, look, here's a good biblical reason why we've been doing things wrong. They were brought in for pragmatic reasons. They were brought in for their aesthetic appeal. They were brought in to coax the young people, to cater to the young people, to worship God. There wasn't this foundational or novel discovery that Scripture permitted the use of musical instruments. It seems that the biblical arguments came after the fact. And so these musical instruments became very, very popular, or I should say again, the organ. Because as I said earlier, it wasn't until the 20th century that the organ switched to the piano and pianos began to be introduced into the worship of God. And from there, we see this rapid increase of the use of musical instruments. Martin Lloyd-Jones, in his day, the greatest preacher of the last generation, Lloyd-Jones, who wasn't opposed to musical instruments per se, begged the church to not give in to this rapid descent in worship, but to return again to the worship of our Reformed forefathers, to return again to that spiritual and plain and simple worship that the New Testament commends to us. And then, as these pianos and organs began to be introduced into the church, most of you have lived the most recent history where not only do we have organs, not only do we have pianos, now those have been replaced with full-blown praise bands. And you have your guitars, and you have your drums, and you have your trumpets, and you have your fiddles or violins or whatever, and it's a whole ensemble on this stage really performing, in some cases, the worship time of singing. That is briefly a survey of church history. And again, it's a pragmatic argument. But I have one goal in mind this morning, and it's simply this: to do what I can to perhaps inject you with a little confidence that what we do and what we believe and how we worship and our practice, held up to the light of church history, is not a strange anomaly. That if you had been a member of the church 150 years ago, 200 years ago, which isn't that long in the grand scheme of church history, it probably would have been largely commonplace that you would not hear musical instruments in the worship of God. And so that's simply what I want to say this morning, that maybe this is a compelling argument to you. But church history testifies largely to the worship of God that does not include musical instruments. And as I said earlier, next week, if the Lord is willing, we will take up the biblical reasons why we don't use musical instruments. I don't want to just leave it here at history. I think some of those who have spoken in history have spoken to the issue that we will be tackling, and that is that musical instruments were tied very closely to temple worship, and temple worship now being fulfilled in Jesus Christ. We are not to return to those ceremonies and those rituals. So that will be the biblical case that I attempt to make next week, if the Lord is willing.